у вас на Западі.
You know what your problem is in the West, and this applies to Macron, to Merz, and so on. They're all just temporary placeholders. Get that?
Are you a dictator? Do you see yourself as a dictator?
You talk about human rights and democracy at home, but in reality, nothing changes. Could it be that your country is a dictatorship? Listen, you've always pushed us, Ukraine, Belarus, and the other post-Soviet republics, into confrontation with Russia. We've long understood how Western policies work. I'm under no illusions. I'm not their son of a bitch. They would gladly chew me up and spit me out. America's leadership now realizes that they are a superpower, but not an all-powerful force.
If there is a change that's about to take place in the world, if we're going to see the West somehow reach out to a country like Russia, for example, it is through that man that you just saw that it will likely happen. That's Alexander Lukashenko, and he is the president of Belarus. And he may very well be the go-between, the linchpin between Washington, for example, and Moscow. This is why we're here. I am coming to you from Belarus, Minsk, the capital, and this happens to be the presidential palace. And let me tell you now why this story is so important at this particular time and place. And let me tell you why it's particularly important given what's going on right now in the world. So, to many of us who grew up in the West, this country and that man you just saw, Mr. Lukashenko, is a dictator who doesn't allow free elections and who imprisons his own people. That's the only story we've ever heard. That's the story that's put out by the Western media. But there's more to that story, and more to that story that is unfolding right now in particular. Given what just happened in Hungary with Viktor Orban, given what we've seen play out in places like Ukraine, for example. So, while some would see him as a dictator, he says he's a man who is, in fact, beloved by his people. What do the polls say? What do the surveys say? He also says that from time to time, he feels like there are people in his country who are trying to take him down, undermine him, and that they are being led, if not instigated, by the West, that they literally are being hired and are meeting with Western leaders, and that's why he feels like he has to punish those people. So it comes down to two stories about one particular country, one particular place, at a time when the world is, in fact, changing, and countries like Belarus are truly pushing back. So what is the truth? What is his story? We decided we wanted to find out. And the best way to do that is to sit down for a conversation with this man, this so-called dictator of this country, here in Belarus at the presidential palace. With that, here now, my interview with the president of Belarus, Mr. Alexander Lukashenko. Mr. President, thank you so much for joining us. And you want me to call you Alexander?
Это ваше право.
As you wish.
Как вам удобнее.
Whatever works for you.
The formal address is always Mr. President. But I want to start with this. I come from the West. I come from America. Our view of your country and yourself is usually very stilted. And one of the things that I don't think is talked about enough is you are very much an anti-corruption president. That is your ethos. Where does that come from?
As for my stance on corruption, it goes all the way back to my childhood. You know, I come from a very poor family. I've seen a lot of injustice in my life. Even though the USSR aspired to be building a life that would be fair and just for all, there was still plenty of injustice back then. And I think you hit the nail right on the head asking that question. My passion for justice stems from the fact that I experienced a lot of injustice and decided firmly that fighting for justice would be the foundation of my policies to the utmost possible extent. Corruption is a terrible thing that screams injustice. If you Dig deep, corruption lies at the root of some of the most terrible things in life, including wars, if you look closely. So it all comes from there. And do forgive my immodesty, since I often revisit my performance as president and I note both the positive and the negative aspects of it. I'd say that my best quality is that I've managed, despite everything, to preserve this urge to fight injustice. It is my motto.
You know, I think, as I read about your history, Mr. President, I see that you are one of the leaders in this part of the world that combined the experience of the Soviet Union, the collapse of the Soviet Union, the transition between collapse and the new orders, and what Belarus has become today. So you knew at the time, for example, you did something very interesting. You opposed the shock economic therapy for your country. You did not let people just come here and take over the economy. You were very careful to block that. I think that was a big part of why you're so anti-corruption. You saw something others didn't see.
Well, in principle, you're right. As for the shock caused by the collapse of the Soviet Union and what shock therapy we could use, basically, following the dissolution of the USSR, we all started from square one. Leaders of the West gave us a lot of advice and guidance. They told us how to build our new lives. But as it turned out today, it was all lies, Western lies. I've been thinking about this a lot and have been consulting experts on how to move forward. Speaking of the future, I believe we need to revisit seriously our ways of governing the country, perhaps even implementing government reform drawing on past experience. If we recall what the Western leaders, first and foremost the American ones, advised us to fight against, I believe it was Article 6 of the Soviet Constitution, which identified the Communist Party as the leading and guiding force of our society. For all the shortcomings of the Communist Party and the ways it ran the country, and I was a member of the Communist Party once, things were not easy.
You could say that within the party, I was a kind of a constructive oppositionist.
My position was defined by life itself, and you know it's a rule that I stick to this day. Whenever you don't know what to do, you have to look at the people. They will show you the way. If you've got your eyes open, they might not tell you directly, but you should be able to see what needs to be done based on the realities of their life. So the West recommended us to introduce a multi-party system and foster plurality of views, and so on and so forth. They recommended it, and we followed. Russia was, of course, at the forefront. It was Yeltsin's Russia, led by Boris Yeltsin. I'm not judging him here. They were good things about him, too, and everyone else rushed to follow the lead. People opened their minds to the cult of money and wealth. And you know, many lost their bearings and got on this money-grabbing track in order to become rich, to be loaded. And then you know how it all played out, especially if we look at Russia. Those who were closer to power got their hands on oil and gas enterprises and became really wealthy. Belarus was on that track as well. When I was an MP, I saw all that. And thank Lord, I was never a supporter of that, of course. I voted against the dissolution of the Soviet Union. Perhaps it was time to reform the Soviet Union. I believe it was. There was a lot of nonsense in the USSR, just as there is a lot of it now in America. You've got a lot of good stuff, but enough nonsense as well. If you're wondering where it can take you, just look at the Soviet Union. So I stated my position openly in Parliament. It's all on the record. I was against going down that slippery slope. And when I became president, long before I had the kind of power I have now, I began reforming Belarus to prevent what happened in Russia from happening in my country. I stopped the stupid, unnecessary reforms in their tracks. Belarus began learning to live within its own means, also relying on whatever help a then devastated Russia could offer. And we got what we could. You probably know our system well.
Well, the reform is good, but if the reform means that people from the West will come here and steal your resources, own your resources, and create this crony capitalism that you saw and predicted and fought against, then that's not good. It seems like you did the right thing. I want people in my country and in the West to understand what your motivation was and why you did that, because I don't think they do. All they hear is criticism of you from the West. So it seems to me that you did this. And let me ask you this question then, based on that. Is that why old Europe and elite Europeans hate you to this day and are fighting you? Was that the beginning of their contempt for you?
Well, you're quite the romantic. You see, we just can't explain these things to the European Union and to the West in general. Wanting to explain to them is the right thing, but they don't want the right thing. Neither America nor the European Union want the right thing. They only want what benefits them. That's for starters. Then I'd really like to thank you for wanting to explain these things to them. It's important to keep trying. There are many reasonable politicians in the West who can hear facts and trust them. A fact is always a fact, no matter how hard some might try to wipe us out and remove us from life, we're still here. It would be reckless to say that we're living well. It would be reckless of a president, because we've got everything in our life, both good and bad things. But I always tell my people that we live as well as we deserve to. We have quite real opportunities to live better, to live well even, but that depends on each individual. My task and the government's task is to create opportunities for a normal, honest and fair life, particularly honest and fair because breaking the law, acting unjustly in order to try and fill one's pockets at the expense of others, enriching oneself at the expense of others, this is not our policy. And we deal harshly with that, no matter what it costs us, because such things lead to wars. At the very least, they create internal political tensions that might start a civil war in the country, which can spill over, the way it did in Ukraine, into a war with your neighbours. I know this very well, and I try to prevent it. As for the European Union, their main failure is their thoughtless policies. They don't tend to think ahead. To this very day, and I'll tell you why, they've relied mostly on America and thought that America would offer a solution to all of their problems. But President Trump told them, your problems are yours, and they have nothing to do with America. Although they do. But still, he distanced himself from the European Union and even from NATO, and he's fully focused on American issues and all other interests of the United States, like their interests in Venezuela, Cuba, partly in Iran, and the confrontation with China. So the European Union should have long ago made its objective, both strategically and tactically, to become an independent pillar of the global community. Regardless of how they feel about me, if you've followed my policies closely, you know that I've always been in favor of the European Union. It was not because they were friendly to my country and I was trying to build a relationship with them, but because the European Union, the United States of America, China, India, and Russia are all pillars of the global community. And the more pillars the world has to rely on, the more stable our planet will be. My unyielding support of the European Union has been guided by this consideration, even though Europe itself has been hostile towards Belarus and branded Belarus an ally of Russia, of China, even of the United States of America now, and whatnot. And yet, we're right here, a small state by the standards of Russia, America, or China, and modern, sovereign, and as independent as possible. We are here, right in the center of Europe. This is where God has placed us.
Mr. President, you're unique. You don't kowtow to old Europe. You challenge the elite Europeans and Washington. And they, meanwhile, refer to you as, you know this, a dictator who fixes elections and jails his oppositions. They consider you a persona non grata. Does that bother you? It has to bother you somewhat, because most people in your position want to be loved by Europe. Do you care that they don't love you?
You know, Rick, I'm a practical person. And again, that's not because I was an experienced politician. When I became president, I was a green politician. I wasn't even 40 at the time, but the Lord prompted me to perceive the reality as it is. And he always guided me, and I believe he did, even though I was once an atheist. And he made me understand that not everyone was going to love me, especially so if I were to be radical, even if it were for the sake of justice or things like that. People might not always see eye to eye with me, and so if I were to be a radical, a lot of people might dislike me. I was prepared for that, although I remember one of my conversations with Boris Yeltsin. I was not in a great mood when I saw him, and he asked me, what happened to you? Why the long face? And I've been reading the opposition press, including the Western press, and there was all that dirt, which, above all, was simply unfair. Those things they wrote about me simply weren't true, so I told him that, and he laughed and asked me, why are you even reading that stuff? That meant a lot to me, and I still remember it to this day. Yes, I do read a lot, and I read everything. I might ignore some things and react very strongly to others when I feel it serves justice. Justice is important to me. If someone writes something, especially on social media, we run checks and verify it. And you know, 99% of the time it proves to be false. So that's why I've always been far from setting myself up for universal love. You know, I'm no emperor like Donald Trump or Vladimir Putin. They can afford to ponder the subject of people's love. They're big players akin to emperors. While I am the leader of a medium-sized country in Central Europe, and I understand that I don't have the same capabilities as they do. And that helps me to keep my head cool about love, especially after all the years of serving as president. I'm an experienced person now, and I don't even have to reflect on it. It's already part of me. Whenever I read bad things about me, like being called a dictator and so on, I keep my cool. When the West labeled me Europe's last dictator, I responded by saying, well then, hurry up, because I am Europe's last dictator. I turned it into a joke, although...
Are you a dictator? Do you see yourself as a dictator?
I'm not, by no means. I don't have the kind of resources it takes to dictate. President Trump has the resources, and he dictates his terms to Venezuela and Cuba, your place of birth. He tries to dictate his terms to Iran, to China, and to varying degrees to all countries. He has the resources. I have a degree in history. I know how things went down in history. If you don't have the resources, don't try to dictate. Also, dictatorships always ended with some kind of failure, a collapse, much like what has happened with the US and Iran just now. You can't call it a collapse, but it's something close to a failure. So a dictator has to be very careful and cautious. They have to think really well and, as we say, keep their head on their shoulders.
They say that you fix elections. Do you fix elections, Mr. President?
You know, I've thought a lot about it. That I've won all my elections is a fact. If I got 85, 86 or 87% of the vote, and if there was something off regarding 0.5%, 1.5% or 2%, I wasn't even aware of that. There are real people behind each election. So I thought to myself, even if they doctored maybe 0.5% of the vote count, even if I didn't get 87% or 85 but 84%, what does that change in the grand scheme of things? It's important to me because there are real people behind each percentage. That's why I'm categorically opposed to the idea that I fixed elections and usurped power. Recent polls show that my approval ratings have picked up significantly, even after the last election. Nobody denies this, not even those who fled Belarus, the Americans or the Europeans. Why did the Americans agree to hold talks with me, a man who fixed elections? Because they know the score. They know who really runs this country and what the role is of the opposition, which ran away. Sure, you'd like them to be strong to come back to Belarus and grab power, but that would be too cruel, too presumptuous. That's not going to happen. They know this, which is why they talk to the real leadership, the people who are really in charge here.
I read that, in fact, I'm going to follow up on what you said. I read you have 78% support here in your country amongst the people who vote for you. And that was a poll that was conducted. So of course I said, I don't believe that. Let me do some more research. So then I went and I checked Chatham House, right? And Chatham House is an organization in London. They hate Belarus, they hate your government, they hate Russia, they hate China, obviously. They have you at 70%. They did a poll in this country and found that 70% of the people either like you or are neutral about you. So I'm thinking to myself, Mr. Trump, Mr. Macron, Mr. Starmer, Mr. Mertz would love to have those numbers. If you put all of their approval numbers together, they don't equal yours. So one does ask themselves, if you're a dictator, why do 70% of the people in this country approve of you?
It's hard for me to weigh in on this. It's probably true to some extent. As politicians, we can get somewhat jealous of one another. It's true, you're absolutely right. And I myself have thought a lot about it. A Western politician could only dream of having not even 78 or 80% approval, but 60 at least. There could be an element of jealousy, but that's not the foundation of their policy towards the Belarusian president or Belarus as a whole. You know, as I were their man, if I were a facade for their policies, they'd be just fine with me. But I'm different. I can't be a yes man. I can't be a facade for anyone, including Trump. It's not about my character. It's about the fact that I'm the first president of Belarus, and the policies of my successors will be largely defined by my policies. Which is why I must, as we like to say, lay a solid foundation for the functioning of the state and for the future president's reasonable and positive policies. I think about the future. I'm not immortal. When I'm gone tomorrow or the day after tomorrow, what will Belarus be like? What will the next presidents do? What will be my legacy? What will the next generation inherit? This is key. You know what your problem is in the West, and this applies to Macron, to Merz, and so on. They're all just temporary placeholders. Get that? They're here today, gone tomorrow. They're just trying to grab something while they can. That's the foundation of their policies. They don't care about the people of France, Germany, etc. And that's their problem. They used to lecture us, Russia, our country, Kazakhstan, Ukraine and others. But now it's them who should come to us to learn and draw conclusions. But they don't want to learn and draw conclusions. The same thing with your Trump. Who is he? He's a placeholder. He only has 4 years. What can he do in 4 years? Nothing. He'll do nothing. A president should have enough time to enter these turbulent waters and draw some conclusions.
Do you feel like they're controlled? The president, the prime minister of the UK, the president of France, the chancellor of Germany, the president of the United States, my president, they tend to not have real control of their governments. They become almost puppets to donors and very wealthy people, it seems. Is that what you're intimating? Is that what I'm hearing you say? That the perspective you have, whereas you have more control and are better able to lead your country?
I appoint the government, supervise its work, and bear responsibility for the outcomes. In your case, it's not clear who appoints whom and who's responsible for what. People are used to having a specific person or a group of people who are responsible for the result. It's very fuzzy in the West. The people there don't know who they can hold accountable. If you try to hold Merz or Macron accountable, they'll say, that's the limit of our powers. Someone else is responsible for the rest, and they don't want to have more responsibility. In my life, there was a moment when I didn't have the kind of power I have now, but I assumed as much responsibility as I could, and I told the people, now I'm in charge. It's something all responsible politicians should do if they want to do something for their people. And you're right, the crux of the problem is that they have too many rich donors who finance them. Over time, they begin to prioritize the interests of these donors, not the people of Germany, France, or the UK. They've served a term, lined their pockets, and left. They're doing just fine while their people are suffering. This is why I call into question and criticize their system of government and appointments to government offices.
There is in Belarus then, you tell me, Mr. President, there is no administrative state above you. There are no donors that you have to call every day and ask permission for. There is no neocon network. There is no people involved in military production who you have to please or feed. There is none of that in your government? None of that?
Yes.
Oh, yes, there is. There is someone. At the risk of sounding banal and not popular enough, I'll say it's the people who elected me. I'm prepared to do anything if it's in their interest. The main objective is to preserve this bit of land where we and our children will live, so there is a higher authority. As for donors, etc., we have many people who sponsor various events. I never say no if it's something for our people, be it in the field of sports, healthcare, or anything that benefits people. However they may criticize me, nobody can say I've ever taken anything from anybody or have done something for the sake of a donor or a rich person. Nobody. Well, they could say that, but they wouldn't be able to back up that allegation with facts. There are no facts. It's a line I would never cross. I can't allow myself to be rebuked for taking something for my own benefit from any donors. I have everything. I'm the president. My people, my state, make sure I can feel safe and continue to do my job as a president. I don't need anything. An advantage I have is that I don't think I have very much longer to live. And if I'm no longer president, the state will provide a place for me to live and a modest pension or salary for me to subsist on. As someone who was born into a poor family, so to speak, I'm not really used to this luxury. It's not the most important thing for me. Whatever they say about me, we're the product of our environment. It all comes from real-life experiences. I didn't have rich parents. I'm not used to luxury. I must have inherited this attitude from my mother. She always told me, don't touch what's not yours, son. Don't take it, it's wrong. It'll hit you sooner or later. I remember that, and that's what I teach my children.
You're making me think of something which I think maybe others in the West should think of. So we're told you're a dictator, right? But my country, we're a democracy, right? So in my country, the people decide, and in your country, only you decide. But when you really think about the results, I'm thinking, in my country, we elect a new president every 4 years, but we get the same policies, same corruption, same wars, same problems, with no matter who we elect. You're here for 30 years,
and there is seemingly a consistency, and you have more than 50-60% consistently supportive of the people. So maybe we have it figured out wrong. Maybe there's a story here that we need to be able to explain to people.
You're absolutely wrong. When you talk about some kind of democracy, human rights, etc., it's all baloney. Your Venezuela policy, threats to Cuba, the war in the Middle East, as well as other things, demonstrate that the real dictator is you. You're not Democrats. There's no democracy or human rights. Look, what human rights are you talking about if you, say, bombed a school in an independent sovereign country that's located tens of thousands of kilometers away from you and that never threatened you? You bombed a school, killing children and their teachers. Almost 200 people dead. Many more died because you encouraged Israeli strikes. What human rights are you talking about? If you advocate for human rights, let people exercise their main right, the right to life. The people wanted to live, especially the kids, and you destroyed them. This is just one recent fact that completely negates everything you've been saying all this time. No, you don't have any human rights. You have interests, in this case, oil, natural gas, and control over them, which you pursue by any means, including military. You're prepared to bomb, crush, and smash, unconcerned by the human rights. That's the foundation of a dictatorship. Therefore, whatever you say, and you're right, you talk about human rights and democracy at home, but in reality, nothing changes. Could it be that your country is a dictatorship? I've given you a specific example of your foreign policy and your democracy. As I've been saying for a long time, you'll have to learn democracy. We have 100 times more democracy than you have. I mean real democracy and real human rights. What human rights can you pontificate about if you kill people? So you killed a guy. What rights does he have? He's dead.
People here like you, it seems to me. I've looked at the numbers. People are content with you. There's people who don't like you, and there's people who criticize you, but generally speaking, people here like you. Under your idea that a man like you, who loves his country, can be a democratic force in his country, and that people in our Western countries, where we always change leaders, are actually more of a dictatorship, fine, I will accept that argument. But what if you tomorrow turn into a monster? What if you do some of the horrible things that you just described? Can people in Belarus get rid of you? Is there an action plan for that?
You know, if I turn into a monster, it's clear that I'll lose the trust of very many of my supporters. Belarusians are genetically unable to and will never support monsters. It's in their DNA. That's where our history has led us and our entire civilization, including Russia and Ukraine. We just can't have monsters. That's number one. Now, with the amount of power I have, or the presidents of Russia, or, say, Kazakhstan have, the leader might try to go off the rails, as they say.
Incapacitated mentally, yes.
Yes, he might, but it would backfire. The people wouldn't accept that, and I understand that. This understanding doesn't allow me, even if I felt such an urge, to turn into a dictator and a monster. The Belarusian people wouldn't let me. That's number one. Second, some of our neighbors would be quite happy if I were to lose my grip. That would give them the grounds to tell the Belarusian people, look at the monster you have, let's unite against him. It would be a fair pretext, a convenient and legitimate reason for my external opponents and enemies to act against me. I understand that very well. I've learned that lesson. But the danger you just mentioned exists in any country. It arises wherever a president lacks restraint, where there are no reasonable checks and balances, not the kind you once tried to teach us, but real effective ones. And the most sensible check and balance is the people. Take Ukraine as an example. On a personal level, I feel a connection to it, as some of my ancestors were born there long ago. I feel sorry for the Ukrainian people. Before this interview, I reflected on this and came to the conclusion that ultimately, Ukrainians are paying for their own decision. After all, they elected Zelensky as president. They did. They knew he lacked experience. They knew his shortcomings, perhaps not fully, but why vote for him then? And still, they chose him. Of course, Zelensky was inexperienced, and I used to be quite as green as him at one time. But I had a solid ground under my feet, some life experience. He came from the world of entertainment, and Ukrainians knew that too. Still, they elected him. Admittedly, the alternatives were not much better, but they made that choice, and now they're paying for it, and paying a very high price. So I have no right to reproach the Ukrainian people. Let them sort it out themselves. They bear some responsibility. They elected this president through a democratic process, and they must answer for that choice.
But you know, I think the point that you're making is an interesting one.
You're saying Mr. Zelensky allowed himself to be used as a tool, as a proxy of NATO and the West and Washington and Mr. Biden, right? And in the process, they have hurt themselves as a country. A lot of ex-Soviet countries have done the same thing. They look at the West, oh, I want to be like you. Yes, the West, you haven't done that. You have told the West, no, no, thank you. I don't need you if you're coming here to do that. It's interesting because I think the same thing just happened to Mr. Orban. The EU said $35 billion. If you get rid of Mr. Orban, then we'll give you $35 billion. So it does seem like you've bucked the system of control that has been set up by the West to control small countries like yours. And you've said to them, no, thank you, no, thank you. And that, I continue going back to this, but when you make the comparison to Ukraine, that's the difference. You could have been just like Zelensky in Ukraine, but you chose not to, right?
You've mixed a lot of things together, Ukraine, Belarus, Orban, and so on. I would simply advise you not to rush to judge Hungarian politics or Orban's policies. I won't evaluate his policies myself. I know him well. What you in the media have been conveying to the international community about Orban, I hear it, and I generally agree. He's a pragmatist, a realist, but that's based on what I see in the media. But then, how do you explain the outcome? A two-thirds majority in parliament, a constitutional majority, and yet Orban lost. That suggests there were serious flaws in his policies, especially domestic ones. After all, it was real people inside the country who voted, and you can't say that they were simply mistaken. The margin was too large. That means the opposition, led by Magyar, offered a clearer and more appealing alternative. So the real question is why Orban lost. Perhaps there was a lot of talk, but enough action at home, and the opposition capitalized on that. I wouldn't even fully call it an opposition movement, considering how it was formed around Magyar himself. As far as I know, he once worked with Orban and began his career alongside him, if I'm not mistaken. So much of this has its roots in the same party they both belong to, Magyar and Orban. But he eventually broke away from that line of politics.
But let me just interrupt you for a moment. Do you believe the EU influenced the opposition, worked with his opponent, funneled funds and marketing experts to his opponents? And that may be part of the reason he lost. Not total reason, but part of the reason.
Yes, they funded and supported him. Orban knew that. He understood the European Union wouldn't be on his side. But that's what politics is, and he had an entire party behind him. He should have resisted. The EU openly backed the opposition, just as openly the Americans supported Orban. So that's not the point. The real issue lies in the mistakes he made in domestic policy. Time will show who was right and who was wrong, but what you're suggesting is secondary. The West has supported and financed our opposition for years as well. And what of it? Nothing. Because despite all our mistakes and shortcomings, we've pursued a generally sound policy toward our own people, and we can explain our actions to them. Just one more minute. In your question, you tied several things together, and I even said it became a bit of a jumble. Ukraine, Orban. You asked why Ukraine, why Belarus? Let's return to where you started. Corruption. In Ukraine, the struggle for power unfolded in such a way that all the key figures were wealthy. In the end, it came down to Zelensky and Poroshenko, both tied to big money, I suspect. And in fact, we know that for sure, that not all of that wealth was earned by them. Many of these wealthy figures are connected to the West, which gives the West leverage over them. I had a good relationship with Poroshenko and know him well. I also know Vladimir Zelensky reasonably well. Despite my criticism, I sympathize with him in many ways. He inherited Ukraine as it was. Yes, he should have changed the course, but he didn't. He failed to reverse the surge of nationalism that had taken hold of Ukrainian society. And because he lacked experience, he didn't fully control many of the processes at play. As a result, nationalist forces gained the upper hand, and he couldn't manage them. We had something similar in Belarus, but with God's help, I was able to deal with it. He wasn't. Perhaps he lacked character or experience needed to know how to act. At that time, if Ukraine had been led by a level-headed leader focused on supporting the people, They would have rallied behind him, perhaps even more strongly than people once did in Belarus. But he didn't do that. He didn't become a leader then, and he hasn't become one now. He needs to understand that the price being paid for what has happened, for the policies pursued, for the war now underway, is far too high. He must recognize that if he doesn't stop, he risks losing Ukraine altogether. He has to weigh the situation and draw the necessary conclusions. That's the harsh reality of politics, having to weigh and decide. Instead, he has once again chosen the path of militarization. Once again, he's going along with the West, which promises him money and weapons.
So you believe that Zelensky sold out, that Zelensky gave himself away to the West, to Washington, and they used him to weaken Russia, which provoked Russia into having to go into Ukraine. That's the way you see the problem between Ukraine and Russia, correct?
Слушайте.
Listen, you've always pushed us, Ukraine, Belarus, and the other post-Soviet republics, into confrontation with Russia. Always. And even Zelensky understood that. I knew it too, and I still do. In Russia, you sometimes hear critics say cautiously, Lukashenko is pursuing a multi-vector policy. He's talking to the Americans, engaging in dialogue. He's trying to build relations with the Baltic states, with Poland, even with Ukraine. For God's sake, these are our neighbors, given to us, as I often say, by God. And, as God intended, we should build relations with our neighbors, whatever they may be. That's what politics is about, choosing the right approach, the right strategy for normalizing relations with those around you. Yes, I often criticize the leaders of these countries, Lithuania and others. They're reckless, they're wild. They don't think about the future. They act in the interests of the wealthy, in the interests of the US, NATO, and Europe. But they should be thinking about their own people. They say, we're a small nation. There are no small or large nations. The Lithuanian people are proud and independent, and the policy should serve them, but it doesn't. So we try to build relations with them, no matter what they're like. It doesn't always work, not in everything, but it takes patience. That's our job as politicians. The same applies to Ukraine and the US. If someone in Russia criticized me for negotiating with the Americans, I can ask in return, don't you also maintain dialogue with them? Of course you do. But I'm not engaging with the US against Russia or China. At our very first meeting, I told them plainly, Russia and China are not just our partners, they are our friends. When the Americans and Europeans slapped us with sanctions, it was Russia and China that opened their doors for us. In many ways, that's what saved us. So why would I now pursue any policy against them? Especially when we have a formal alliance treaty with Russia, the closest possible kind. Trying to build a union state, walking on thin ice, moving forward step by step. The West knew all of this, and I strictly honor that agreement. So, as for this so-called multi-vector policy, it's driven by economics. We produce more than half of our goods and services for export. Ours is an open economy. That means we have to pursue our interests in the West, in Russia, in China, in Africa, everywhere others are active, whether Russia or the US. That's simply our national interest. As I said recently, it's about living, not merely surviving. It's our interest that stems from life needs. So what is there to reproach us for? Nothing. We've long understood how Western policies work. No matter what talks they conduct with me, I'm under no illusions. I'm not their son of a bitch. They would gladly chew me up and spit me out. I understand that perfectly, but even so, not because I'm Lukashenko, but because I'm the president of this country and its people, I have to act in the interests of the nation, not my own.
But you're bucking the system. You're not supposed to do that, Mr. President. You're supposed to hate Russia. You're not supposed to go meet with President Kim of North Korea. You're not supposed to do that. But you do that anyway, which is what makes you... Some people have two opinions of you. You are a bad guy because you have friends they don't want you to have, or you're a really interesting guy because you can get along with the West while you can still have friends with North Korea and a trilateral relationship between you, Mr. Putin, and Mr. Kim. So that's what makes you so unique, and that's what makes them hate you, I think, right?
Going against the grain, that's in my nature. You're right, and perhaps it's not always a good thing. But let me say this, you should and can only be friends with those who want to be friends with you. What kind of friendship could I possibly have with Starmer or Biden? How could I be friends with someone who imposed sanctions on me? And European leaders were effectively tightening a noose around my neck. kind of friendship is that? With Putin, we're friends, even more than just friends. We communicate as brothers. He wants that relationship to be friends, and I value it. The same goes for Xi Jinping. We've established a good annual tradition, what the Chinese call family meetings. We'll be meeting again soon in an informal setting. I visit him with my youngest son, who graduated from Peking University. We spend time together at his family place. We talk. And Kim in North Korea, you've demonized him, but he's a wonderful, intelligent, well-educated man. He's defending his country's interests. He's not bothering anyone, but you're trying to destroy him. He's a tough man doing what he believes is necessary to protect his country. He's open to good, friendly relations with me, and I have no objection. These are the kinds of people you can be friends with, not because they're America's enemies, but because they're willing to engage. If Donald Trump is ready to build friendly relations, whether personally or between Belarus and the US, we're open to that. We would welcome it. Ideally, everyone should get along, even if that's not really possible. If that were the case, there would be no wars, only mutual assistance. Cuba and the US could coexist peacefully, as could Venezuela, Panama, Colombia, and Nicaragua, would then all look to the US with respect, if not affection. But that requires a genuine desire for a friendly relationship. And again, you can only build friendship with those who want it. If European leaders don't want to be friends with me, that's the reality. It's not me refusing them, but vice versa. Then how can we possibly create a friendship under those conditions?
Do you see a day you are one of the people who is leading a move for a brave new world in the future? You may not be around, I may not be around, maybe we're too old to see this, but maybe our children will see this, where countries like North Korea, Belarus, Iran, China, Russia, South Africa, Brazil, I could go on, where these countries become a formidable enough force to not defeat the West, but stand next to them as equals. Do you see that day coming? And is that part of what drives you?
God grant that such a time may come. Based on the current climate and situation, it's hard for me to believe such a time will come. But despite certain foolish things and despite certain impulsiveness, Trump has done a great deal toward that. Trump has shown the whole world that your United States is not all-powerful. In Iran, he revealed that they are not all-powerful. I don't think he's so stupid as to not understand that. And that gives grounds for...
Not a superpower, right?
In terms of might, it's a superpower, but it's not an all-powerful force. Everyone understands that. And America's main enemy is China. If the Americans were unable to deal with Iran, I said this long ago, then don't meddle with China. They possess so much more power than the US will never be able to cope with. Not with a ground operation, not with an air operation, not in any way. If they unleash a war against China and your aircraft carriers approach, the Chinese will destroy them within the first day. I think Trump understands that. And even Hegseth, your Minister of War or Defense, I don't know exactly what he is over there, he understands that too. He's not a stupid man. And even your fellow countryman, Rubio, understands that as well. America's leadership now realizes that they are a superpower, but not an all-powerful force. And by doing so, and this is the main thing, they gave hope that once the Americans understand this, they will begin to consider the interests of countries other than China and Russia. Russia is a huge territory. They will achieve nothing with their missiles. They will run out of missiles before Russia runs out of territory. Iran showed that too. I'm not even talking about the consequences. The Middle East, the global economy, and so on. They all suffered because of that mad adventure in Iran. I'm not even talking about that. I'm talking about facts that are plainly evident. They demonstrate that the Americans must stop and realize that, aside from the interests of the United States, Greenland, Cuba, Venezuela, Nicaragua, the Panama Canal, and the rest of the Western Hemisphere, they are countries that have interests of their own, even in the Western Hemisphere. Mexico, right there on your border, has interests of its own too. You shouldn't keep kicking Mexico around. You shouldn't keep kicking Cuba around either. In Cuba and Mexico, I know this well, and in Nicaragua and Venezuela, the majority of people understand what the United States is. And normal relations with Americans need to be built. Well then, build those relations. Why, for example, why did you seize Maduro? Was that really so hard for such a powerful nation to do in Venezuela, a country with problems? Venezuela has a lot of problems that the authorities are not happy about. It was no problem to invade and seize the president. Why am I saying this? Because on the eve of this, I discussed the issue with the US delegation. Completely pragmatic people. I told them this. There's no need to fight the Venezuelans. You need to come to terms with them. Oil? Well, the oil Venezuela's producing was meant to be refined in the United States. The refineries there were built for exactly that purpose. It will end up reaching you anyway. Make an agreement with Maduro about it. I learned this from Chavez. Chavez was prepared to come to an agreement with them, but Chavez was a military man with a strong character. Maduro is the same. They cannot tolerate your diktat. So you decided to seize him. And you thought you'd solved the problem, but you actually created one. What comes next? What are you going to do with Maduro? Unless you have completely lost your mind, you should back off. There's no need to admit mistakes or anything. Back off and release the man and reach an agreement with Venezuela. They will come to an agreement with you because they know what the U.S. is, just like other countries do. If you also push your way into Cuba and start fighting the Cubans, history shows you will get more than you bargained for. There will be countries that quietly and calmly supported Cuba. And what that will lead to is hard to say. This is not Iran, thousands of kilometers away from you. This is Cuba, which is in your own backyard, not far from Donald Trump's home in Philadelphia. Do you need that? No, you don't. So you need to think about whether this is even possible. It's highly problematic. Do you know why? I told the Americans this too, so I have the right to tell you as well. Donald Trump has no people around him who will tell him, you're wrong. Biden, Obama, and Clinton were tolerant of differing opinions. I know this for certain, as I knew Obama and Clinton personally. And there were people who told them no. During Trump's first term, there were people who told him no as well. Take Bolton. I think he was somewhere on the National Security Council. He told him no directly. Well, it is clear how that ended. But Trump is no fool. He understood that there were other opinions. But now everyone hangs on his every word, standing at attention saying, yes, yes, Donald, you're right. Act, bomb, break, smash. And on top of that, with regards to the military, he's not directing his Ministry of War. Instead, he's making concessions to them. But he should be the commander-in-chief, and he should command. Trump has no team in which there are people who will tell him no. And he himself has said openly that the main thing guiding his policies is his own feelings. Well, you know, I can tell you this as a president. Your feelings can sometimes lead you in the wrong direction. You must know how to listen to people, especially when you hold such power, when you lead such an empire. You must know how to listen to people, pay attention to their opinions, and draw the correct conclusions. If you don't have that ability, it's a big problem. Trump is probably beginning to understand this, but there is no longer time to correct it and build a normal policy. But as we understand, and you do too, he's done a great deal that is bad. Yet he's also shown the whole world the true face of the United States and revealed its real capabilities. They are not limitless. And perhaps this situation may force them into taking the interests of others into account. That would mean a bright future is not far off.
I'm wondering, were you surprised by how badly the U.S. missile defense system has fared? And were you surprised by how well Iran has done? And final question on that note. To what do you owe Iran's success? Is it their relationship with China and the help China has given them? Maybe Russia's help as well, militarily and in terms of intelligence, for example? How has Iran been able to muster this power to be able to, seemingly up to now, defeat the United States, the biggest power on earth?
You know, there is no need for any conspiracy theories here. You journalists exaggerate everything and present things in a harsh light. Iranian weapons and armaments can't be compared to American ones, and American weapons can't be compared to Iranian ones. You bought several hundred missiles to the Iranian coast on aircraft carriers and other ships, and you have certain weapons deployed there at your bases. This is true. What's the surprise here? Iran knew about all of your positions and where all your weapon depots and stockpiles were in the neighboring Persian Gulf countries, where you have bases, the UAE, Qatar, Kuwait, and Saudi Arabia. They had all been zeroed in, to use military language. They had all been targeted by the Iranians. And having certain weapons, which aren't American, of course, if Iran had weapons on the same level as the Americans, it would have already wiped Israel off the face of the earth at a minimum. Of course, the level of their weapons is a bit lower, but not much. They had drones, they had missiles with ranges as long as 4,000 kilometers, and they struck your bases. Did the Americans not understand that Iran is a mountainous country? They're not fools. Persia. They hid those weapons in the mountains, in places beyond the reach of American missiles, whatever kind of missiles they might be. They hid their weapons, and when you Americans thought you'd won, they struck you with missiles and thousands of drones. Not even Israel's Iron Dome could cope with that, let alone the American bases in the Persian Gulf, or the ships that had brought those missiles there and used them. Yes, you destroyed schools, you destroyed museums, cultural sites, residential buildings, certain power plants and oil fields. You struck them, put them out of commission, destroyed some things, killed some people. You killed Iran's leadership, and that will come back to haunt you. After Venezuela, you showed your face. You killed them, and then what? Others took the place of the leaders who were killed, and they're even more radical. You destroy homes in a residential neighborhood, but the people somehow manage. It's a warm country after all. They simply moved into tents or somewhere else. The fact you killed children does not do you any credit. They cannot be brought back, but that's not a catastrophe for Iran. And with their Shahed drones, which may be a bit worse than the Americans, though not in some respects, they delivered a corresponding strike. And you say Iran won? No. There is no winner here, and there never will be. Peace may have won out for the moment, but it is so fragile that it still needs to be nurtured. A ceasefire has been declared, and now one must move toward peace. And much here will depend on Donald Trump. It seems his intuition and feelings prevailed in the end, and he realized that it was impossible to go any further, as disaster lay ahead. But I want to warn you that Iran and the Muslim world have realized what Americans are, and you must be prepared for the fact that it will not only be the Iranians, the Houthis, and others who will attack Americans around the world. It will be the entire Muslim world, and even those countries you consider friends. They will not simply pursue a policy of caution and wariness. A good many people will emerge there who are set against Americans. You've stirred up the entire Muslim world, and the people there are tough. Unlike you and I, they will not spare their own lives when it comes to defending their values. So you've stirred up such a hornet's nest that it needs to be calmed as quickly as possible. It must be soothed, concessions need to be made, accommodation has to be shown in some areas, but done in such a way that you're not struck all over the world. Do not think you'll be able to hide behind the ocean. There are Americans all over the world. So things may be calm for you in Washington and Florida, but it will be hard for you in other places. Therefore, today, your leaders, Hegseth, Rubio, and Trump, need to find the wisdom to reach agreements, calm things down, and settle things. There's no need to follow Israel's lead. Israel wants to fight, so let it fight.
Well, yes, but the message that the United States and Israel are sending right now is not one of compromise. It's not one of peace. It's of aggression, which is why countries like North Korea aren't attacked. Iran is attacked because my country believed Iran was weak and they've been proven wrong. Your country has tactical nuclear weapons. And I've heard you say you do. I'm asking you, do you have nuclear tactical weapons? And is that why you feel stronger and less apt to be attacked by enemies?
It's not Israel we're protecting against. In fact, many of our compatriots live there now, very sensible folks. A lot of people left the Soviet Union for Israel, and now their children live there too. Quite a few came from Belarus. Plenty of reasonable, clear-headed people there. I'm speaking in general, but mainly about the leadership. As for the United States, I don't think Americans aim to wage war against Belarus. In fact, based on my contacts with people close to Trump, not just politicians, but those close to him, I see the opposite. Even if, God forbid, the Americans wanted to fight us, they would have to do so from the territory of the Baltic states, Poland, etc. Since you've raised this sensitive issue, I made a promise to myself not to dwell on it, but still, my goal here is to warn our neighbors, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, Poland, and to some extent Ukraine. God forbid they commit any aggression against Belarus. We don't want war. We're not planning to start fights with them. No wars will be launched from Belarusian territory against Poland or Lithuania. We have no intention of doing that unless we're dragged into a conflict and forced to respond. We don't want this, but if you do, if you choose that path, then we will defend ourselves with every means available. That doesn't mean that should a confrontation begin, we'd immediately use nuclear weapons against countries who attacked us or are used as a bridgehead to strike at us. We have enough conventional weapons to respond, but if we see a threat to Belarus's very existence, then it's not just us that would act, but also Russia, because we have a treaty together, and it won't be pretty. We will use everything we have. Why do you think I brought in tactical nuclear weapons? Stir up the whole world and scare someone off? No, it's a factor of our defense and security, nothing more. And add to that everything Russia has. We are Russia's ally. Losing Belarus is unacceptable for them. As we used to say, should Belarus go, the enemy would be standing in Smolensk near Moscow. That's not acceptable for Russia. And on top of all that, we're allies, legally bound to each other. Russia has clearly stated it would use its full arsenal to defend Belarus. The whole world knows this. America knows this. Europe knows it. So a clash with Belarus means a clash with both Belarus and Russia. There is a corresponding military force in Western Russia that would support the Belarusian army immediately. And you know what kind of weapons they have. And we do not want war.
Do you think, Mr. President, the Europeans want war with you and Russia? Especially Russia? It sounds like they do. I keep hearing these antagonistic comments from people like Merz, for example, who wants to build up the German army so he can go to war with Russia. He hasn't specifically said that, but he sounds like he's saying that. Does that worry you?
No, that's impossible, at least for now. They don't want it. What happens tomorrow? Time will tell. The world is so turbulent now, so unpredictable, that no one knows what tomorrow will bring, let alone the day after. Right now, they don't want it because it would end badly for them, especially given their strained relations with the United States. They'd have nowhere to run. And let me tell you, they would have to run. Hence, under no circumstances did they want a confrontation with Belarus and Russia, no matter their rhetoric.
Is NATO finished? Do you think a lot of people are saying NATO is finished? Do you think they're either finished or on their last leg?
No. Even if Trump decided that NATO is finished, he wouldn't have enough time to make it happen. Others would come in to save NATO. Also, Trump and his people understand that NATO is not just about warheads and U.S. money. It's a massive strategic foothold for the United States and its allies on the Eurasian continent.
Speaking of Trump, there was talk of you going to Mar-a-Lago and visiting Mr. Trump. Do you still intend to do so? Is that invitation still open?
There's been talk about a big deal for a long time, since the early days of my negotiations with the US. Still, it's not like that I'm dying to visit America or shake Donald Trump's hand. Of course, I would love to meet the man face to face, but that can't be the goal by itself. It's not what matters. Like any normal people, we'd be happy to meet and get along with each other. But we're both presidents, so any meeting has to be properly prepared. Before concluding a major deal, as I see it, there needs to be a draft agreement initialed by those who prepare it, so that we can sign it. It must reflect both American and Belarusian interests, and the US side understands that well. So preparations must be in place. I'm not like Zelensky, who runs to Trump begging for money or weapons. Do I need those? Well, yes, money is good to have. Weapons too, but I understand that my situation is fundamentally different from Zelensky's. Unlike him, I don't need to bow or beg. It would be nice to have more stuff, but we can manage without it. So I'm not in a rush to visit Mar-a-Lago or Washington. It would be useful, sure. It could improve our relations significantly. You know, I was the only president in the world who openly supported Trump. I've always said I'm a Trump supporter. Whatever flaws he may have, I haven't given up on him. I know that meeting with him would be useful, but I can't fill the gap I mentioned before. I mean, not having people around who can say no to him and offer sound advice. I can't replace those people. Anyway, nobody should be losing sleep about this. And to all the Americans, no, I'm not dying to visit your country. It would be nice, but as president, it's not something I can or should do. If Trump is ready to meet, just as I'm ready for dialogue, we'll always find a way. But if the US side isn't ready, then it can wait. If they view it like a meeting between a vassal and his emperor, that won't happen either. This isn't arrogance or posturing. It's the stance of a president who respects his people. I'm ready to have a meeting. We're ready for a deal. But it has to be arranged properly to reflect both US and Belarusian interests. It shouldn't be reduced to what some think, that America's only interest is freeing so-called political prisoners in Belarus. in exchange for lifting sanctions. Look, we've adapted to life under sanctions. It's not a good thing, but we've adapted. People like to mention our potash fertilizers. Sure, we'd love to sell them without restrictions, but this year we don't even have surplus potash or mineral fertilizers to sell. Everything is already contracted, some of it prepaid. We have to find additional supply to even send anything to America. The world is a big place, and we've found ways to deal with the reality at hand. Americans need to understand, many in Europe already have, that sanctions haven't achieved what they were supposed to. We've adjusted. So political prisoners, sanctions, these are secondary issues. We have far bigger matters to resolve. That's what the big deal is going to be about. Once everything is prepared at the ground level, we're ready to meet with Donald and sign the agreement.
Do you think it's possible, and I'll ask you a question about the prisoners in a moment, but is it possible that Mr. Trump is trying to do a deal with Mr. Lukashenko and Belarus as a way of really eventually doing a deal with Mr. Putin and Russia? In other words, he won't get as much attention negatively about this sanction deal that he just completed with you, so he feels more comfortable working with you, with the ultimate goal maybe being to work with Mr. Putin and remove some of the sanctions or assist and create a better relationship with Russia. I'm thinking that might be his end game or his goal. Do you think maybe that's what he's thinking?
I don't know, but I'd be glad if, in the end, Donald Trump saw some bigger picture behind our talks and negotiations. Most importantly, is a way towards restoring normal relations vis-a-vis Russia. That's number one. Secondly, the United States and its leadership need to see one thing clearly. They won't be able to solve any issues in Eurasia without Russia. So there has to be an agreement. I think that's entirely possible. Maybe he's testing to see Belarus's position and then projecting that onto Russia. That would be perfectly reasonable. And for our part, we'll do everything we can to make it happen. Because we understand, if the Americans reach an agreement with Russia, it will be twice as good for us compared to any deal reached with just Belarus. You've got to come to terms with Russia. And you can, especially under Vladimir Putin. He's someone you don't just talk to, but actually reach agreements with. But one thing has to be clear, if you make a promise, you keep it.
Maybe a final question then, Mr. President. You have been in power for 30 years or so. You're a very powerful man. You're very much respected around the world by many, many, many countries. Of course, the West has its criticism of you, but...
Listen, Rick, before I forget, you said something very insightful. The United States' path to Russia runs through Belarus. Curious, right? Historically, only enemies came that way, but Donald could come via Belarus as a peacemaker. A fascinating idea. I'm telling this to my press secretary to take note. Let's include this little idea in the big deal, shall we?
I hope so. Hey, one final question about you and what happens. You look fantastic, by the way. Your health looks good. And if you come to America, you're welcome to come to my home. I just want you to know that.
Rick, большое спасибо за приглашение.
Thank you so much for the invitation, Rick. As long as it's possible, I'd be glad to come. See, we're almost friends now. This is how you build a friendship.
What happens after your decision to step down? At some point, there will be a Belarus without Lukashenko or without you as its leader. What is the next stage for your country? How are you going to make sure that there is a continuum in this country? Have you thought about that?
You know, this is a deeply important question to me as a person. I've done a lot to make Belarus what it is today. I won't say whether the country is good or bad. It is what it is. You said it's a decent country, that people live good lives here, a peaceful, safe country. Naturally, I want to see that preserved. I want it to remain a land of opportunity where anyone can realize themselves. In that sense, we've succeeded. Any person can lead a normal, quiet life here, raise children, get an education, with everything being on equal terms. My son, the president's son, studied in a village school alongside everyone else, and still keeps in touch with many of them. He later got admitted into Peking University, one of the world's top universities, where courses are taught in English. But he worked for it. He was always an overachiever. Under equal conditions, and I made sure of that, he outperformed about half of his classmates. Opportunity is key. Others had them too, and many went on to higher education. That's the kind of Belarus I want to preserve. Some people have more opportunities, some less, but everyone has them. And my life story is an example of that, too.
But will everyone have an opportunity, Mr. President? Whether the future leader of your country, when you and I go fishing or go play golf, is your son or somebody else, will everybody in this country have an opportunity to become the next leader of this country? Or will people be punished for being the opposition? Which is a question that's asked in the West, which I have to ask.
Even if we don't retire, Rick, we'll still go fishing at your place.
Okay. You got it. You got it. Good fishing in Belarus, I read.
When the season starts and it's legal, we can cast a line here in Belarus too. Honestly, only foolish people in the West think that way. Even if I were an actual dictator holding on to power, I'll still pass on eventually and someone else will lead the country. And that's the extreme scenario, but it won't come to that. The decision lies with the people of Belarus. However, they chose, that's how it will be. I remember my first election. I got the people's mandate. I believe I got 83%. No, 80.3% of the vote. That was a very different time. There was a lot of vote rigging, even violence, and I still got 80.3%. I remember it well. The people stood by me very strongly. I keep that ideal in my mind, and I will follow the same path. If the people don't want it, then, like the saying goes, you can't force a person to love you. I believe that long before I pass on, and even before we're both retiring and going fishing in the United States, there will be a capable new person leading Belarus. We've got plenty of smart, talented people.
Mr. President, you have been so gracious with your time. You're so outspoken. You're transparent. You're honest. You really are who you are. And I want to thank you for giving us so much time. This has been really a really important interview that is going to be shared with tens of millions of people around the world. And I'm glad I had an opportunity to sit and talk to you. Thank you, Mr. President.
Thank you.
I really thank you for it.
Here's the question I come away with after doing a two-hour interview with Mr. Lukashenko. I ask myself, is he a dictator because, after all, he's been in power for 30 years? Or has he been in power for 30 years because the people of this country truly like his leadership? And most of the polls seem to indicate that. I think it's a question for you to ask yourself after watching the interview. But I will say this. One does get a sense that this man is different. He thinks the world is changing, and he's hell-bent on making it happen. And he's doing it by forging relationships, not just with one side, but with all sides. He has a relationship with North Korea, as well as China, as well as Russia, as well as the United States. And that, he says, is how he thinks things can change, and perhaps how he himself can make a difference. I'm Rick Sanchez, reporting from Belarus and the Presidential Palace. This is The Sanchez Effect. Thanks so much for being with us. Thank you for letting us into your homes. And we'll be looking for you again next time.